From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many Catholics are leaving the church as the Pope steadfastly opposes artificial contraception, abortion, and homosexuality. On today's Fresh Air, what formed the spiritual and political views of Pope John Paul II? We talk with his biographer, Tad Schultz, a former reporter for the New York Times. Also, we meet the creator of the new sitcom News Radio, Paul Sims. He used to write for The Larry Sanders Show and Late Night with David Letterman. And a new biography of Jackie Robinson inspires some thoughts from our commentator, Gerald Early. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Kansas Senator Bob Dole is running for the Republican presidential nomination. It's his third try. He made his official announcement today in Topeka, Kansas, surrounded by supporters. He's promising to cut taxes, balance the budget, and restore states' rights. Dole would be 73 at the time of the election, but he says he has the experience to help restore America as a great nation. He is the sixth Republican to declare for the presidency. Conservative Georgia Democrat Nathan Deal has switched to the Republican Party. From Peach State Public Radio, Bruce Dorton reports.
Deal, who's in his second term, says he believes the Democratic Party no longer reflects his conservative North Georgia views. He has been among the most conservative Democrats in the House since his election, and his move gives the Republicans a 231 to 203 majority in the House. The switch also changes the makeup of Georgia's U.S. House delegation to 8 Republicans and 3 Democrats. A year ago, there were 7 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Earlier this year, he played a key role in the House welfare debate when he helped develop a Democratic alternative to the measure contained in the Republicans' Contract with America. Deal is the third congressional Democrat to defect since last fall's election. He says politics had nothing to do with his decision. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
President Clinton is promising a series of actions to assist working women. He told a group of labor activists at the White House today he's accepted the findings of a Labor Department survey of 250,000 women. Mr. Clinton says that women deserve the chance to fulfill their dreams.
We want to have opportunities open for women to work and to fulfill their own dreams. And surely that is one of the things that drives women into the workforce. But it's also true that a lot of women work even under the most difficult circumstances simply because they have to. And in either case, what we should want for women is to be able to be successful in the workplace and successful in the home.
The president says one action he'll take is to campaign for a higher minimum wage to $5.15 per hour. The Clinton administration is considering streamlining the Social Security program. Officials are thinking about staggering the mailing of millions of retirement and disability checks that are now sent at the beginning of the month. The suggested changes are part of the Clinton administration's effort to reinvent government. This could save as much as $1 billion over 5 years. Some critics point out that the plan overlooks the most pressing problem of Social Security. The system will be bankrupt in a few years. Others say a second plan to turn over a small piece of Social Security's work to private business poses a risk to privacy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 2 points at 4,194. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Foreign ministers from most Arab nations will meet soon in New York. They'll try to adopt a common stance on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
At least 18 Arab foreign ministers have agreed to meet in New York before the conference later this month on the renewal of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. There, they will try to coordinate their positions on the 25-year-old document. The United States and other nuclear powers are pressing for an indefinite extension of the NPT, which has 172 signatories. But Egypt and Syria have warned they will not support such an extension until Israel agrees to join the treaty as well. So far, Israel has refused to join the NPT, open up its facilities to international inspection, and destroy its reputed arsenal of nuclear warheads until hostile regimes like Libya, Iran, and Iraq abandon their alleged pursuit of nuclear arms. Recent talks between Egypt and Israel have failed to resolve the dispute. There is concern that the matter could strengthen opposition within the Arab and Muslim world against an indefinite extension of the NPT. I'm Sunni Khalid in Cairo.
Striking mass transit workers in Philadelphia have accepted a tentative contract with the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority. Labor leaders are hopeful that full service can resume today. Officials from both sides say the agreement will cover all city transit and the Frontier bus lines serving the suburbs. A third striking division, Red Arrow, is represented by a different union, which is still negotiating. The Red Arrow line covers trolleys and buses running into Philadelphia. A proposed merger in the phone company could create another long-distance company. Frontier Corporation has agreed to buy ALC Communications for about $1.8 billion in stock. The deal would give ALC shareholders 2 shares of Frontier stock for every ALC share they now own. Frontier says a combined firm would have annual revenues of nearly $2 billion and make it the nation's fifth-largest long-distance phone company. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pope John Paul II is leading 1 billion Roman Catholics into the third millennium of the Christian era. My guest, Tad Schultz, has written a new biography of the Pope. It describes him as a champion of religious freedom and tolerance, but a moral absolutist who tolerates no challenge to the Church's moral teachings as they relate to contraception and abortion. Schultz has not written an authorized biography. However, he was able to speak with the Pope and to accompany him on trips around the world. Schultz is a former New York Times reporter and the author of a biography of Fidel Castro, which won an Overseas Press Club award. Less than 2 weeks ago, the Pope issued an encyclical called The Gospel of Life. He asked the world's Catholics to resist crimes which no human law can claim to legitimize, like abortion, euthanasia, the use of embryos for medical research, and capital punishment. I asked Schultz about the importance of this encyclical.
This is the 11th encyclical during his 16 and a half years of pontificate. I think it's the most interesting. It's also the most coherent in the sense of being the easiest to read. Some of the earlier ones were kind of thick and dense. I think what he does in this one, which he has not done before, he addresses himself to all the basic important issues which face, I guess, the modern world, civilization, this whole question of culture of death, which has now become, I believe, the basis of his worldwide universal message. He goes into areas not only of abortion and contraception, which of course are well known and do not break any new ground, other than to reaffirm that he will never, never, never change his mind. But he then enters into a set of new dimensions about that which is happening in the world, to wit, again, his expression, culture of death. He addresses himself to all the post-Marxist situations developing in the world today, all the uncertainties, all the tensions, civil wars. And he also does something very interesting, which I think is extremely basic. He addresses himself to the whole question of science, and specifically the question of biogenetics and genetics in general, which many people will tell you, people in the church will tell you, that the question of genetics is becoming, has become, will become very soon, as much of a crisis as the Galileo question was 300 years ago.
As you put it in your biography, the Pope is loved but often not obeyed. Many Catholics do not follow the Pope's teachings on artificial birth control. And you say, and many people say, that is probably one of the reasons why the Catholic Church seems to be losing members. Did you talk to the Pope about that, about how many people don't follow his teachings on artificial birth control?
He takes the view, and I didn't have to ask him because, he said it so many times in public and private, semi-private, but to restate it, he takes the view, yes, he is aware, for example, that great many people in the church in Latin America and in Africa, for example, are leaving the church for the so-called Protestant sects, like the Pentecostals and Assembly of God. Okay, so he is aware of all this, but it is also part of his basic concept, his basic architecture, in keeping the church together, is that there is no way for him to change his stand on all of the above, because it's natural law, because it's church tradition, because it's the commandments. So therefore, faced with a choice, which of course he is, he prefers to remain with these positions, which are often regarded as conservative, reactionary, retrograde, and all of the above. And he takes the view, I have to be true to myself and to my church, and I prefer, in effect, I'm giving a paraphrase on the quotation here, I prefer, in effect, to have a smaller but disciplined, obedient, and militant church than have to try to please everybody, which I cannot anyway. So I'm prepared to accept, in effect, the reality that there may be fewer of us, but those who will remain with us will be better believers, deeper believers. And this is the cornerstone of this entire question that we are looking at in terms of the church.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tad Schultz, the author of a new biography of Pope John Paul II. You describe the Pope as the first Pope in modern history to be a world diplomat. I'd like to look at how politics affected his early life. Back when he was a student, the Germans had occupied Poland. How did the Nazis try to control the church during Pope John Paul's formative years?
In a whole variety of ways, ranging from sending priests and bishops to concentration camps, such as Auschwitz and others, where many, many died, to closing down seminaries, to limiting all forms of teaching by the church, making it almost impossible for people to become priests, which is why Wojtyła's the Pope's first exposure to Catholic teachings was in the secret underground seminary run in the Archdiocese of Krakow, the town in southern Poland where he lived. The Germans, the Nazis, did almost everything in their power to destroy the Polish church, because they knew, I guess from reading history, that traditionally, historically, in Poland during the occupations, or rather the partitions, when Poland had disappeared in the 18th and 19th century, it was the church that was the, which was the central point for resistance against the occupiers, of whom there were three at the time, Prussians, Russians, and Austrians. That it was the church that maintained the language and the history and patriotism and the faith, that all came together. So therefore, wishing as they did to incorporate much of that country into Germany and destroy whatever vestiges of Polish patriotism, cultural resistance they were, it was as necessary from their viewpoint to destroy the church as, if you will, it was to destroy the Jews. And they were fairly even-handed in killing Poles of Jewish faith and members of the Roman Catholic Church.
You mentioned the secret seminary in which he studied. The archbishop, during the occupation, invited seven seminarians to stay with him and study with him at his palace until the end of the war?
That is right. And this, you know, this kind of, in a way, goes back to the very origins of Christianity, you know, of meeting in secret places and caves to develop the church, build the church, you know, going back 2,000 years. So in a way, on a miniature scale, Archbishop Sapieha of Krakow, by having his secret clandestine seminary, was, consciously or not, replaying the history of Christianity.
So early on in his religious training, Wojtyła learned that being a priest could be a very political act.
Very much so, because, for example, at the same time when he was a laborer in a chemical plant, he was about 18, 19 years old then. He was reading religious works in secrecy, because under the Nazis, to be caught even reading a religious book during work or any time could be in prison or worse. So from the very, very outset, he knew that being a priest is a dangerous occupation.
Did Wojtyla ever get into trouble with the Nazis?
No, only in an indirect sense. He was hit by a German army truck and he remained unconscious for 9 hours and miraculously survived, but this obviously was not planned. I asked him, I said, I understand that most people, they're unconscious for 9 hours, ago into shock and they're dead. I said, how come, Holy Father, how come did you survive? And he said, Providence, my son, Providence. And then his secretary, who was with us at lunch, said the same way it happened on May 13th, 1981, which was the date when he was shot by the Turkish terrorists in St. Peter's Square. And the Pope said, yes, that's the same providence that saved him from the German truck and that saved him from the Turkish bullet.
After the Germans, Wojtyla had to contend with the communists. You say that he angered the communist authorities early on in his religious career, if I may call it a career.
It was.
What did he do early on that angered the communist authorities?
Only when he became auxiliary bishop of Krakow, he began to take what you would call, in the context of the time, independent positions, which meant positions which differed publicly from the law or the practice established by the communist regime at the time. Before becoming bishop, he was he was a teacher of ethics. He was a professor. He was a vicar at student churches in Krakow. And the communists kind of regarded him at the time as a, you know, very pleasant, very erudite, very scholarly young priest who will concentrate on being a nice scholarly priest. When he became bishop, then he took it upon himself to protest all kinds of what he believed were violations of human rights by the communist government in terms of arresting people in churches, of not allowing new churches to be built. And it was the beginning of survey. At that point, still rather low-profile campaign of assertion. He became much, much more outspoken after the very crucial event in his life, which was being named an archbishop, which opened the way to papacy in the long run.
My guest is Ted Schultz. He's written a new biography of Pope John Paul II. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Schultz, he's written a new biography of Pope John Paul II. You've described some of the ways in which Wojtyla was a thrust into very political situations under the Nazis and under the communists. As Pope, he has played a part in international affairs. He's traveled around the world on behalf of human rights, but at the same time, he's condemned liberation theology, and he said that priests can't hold elected or executive office. Do you find that to be a contradiction?
I do. Personally, my own sense of it would be that perhaps the Pope does not fully understand or did not fully understand what liberation theology really was all about. I think that he was led to believe that this was a Marxist or totally Marxist type of approach to church and religion. Yes, of course, in Latin America, there were or are a number of priests who, to a larger or lesser extent, had sympathies with Marxism. But I do think, and this is a, this was a problem for me in the sense of trying to understand why he did things. I don't think he truly understood, again, Latin America being the great case in point, that theology of liberation was something which was simply very well suited to the problems and the environment of Latin America. And no one, I guess, tried or managed to convince him that that in the end this would be probably a positive thing and probably keep the church stronger in Latin America than it has been after he had turned on the theology of liberation and, you know, and related activities.
As a journalist, what was your approach to discussing this seeming contradiction with the Pope? Did you frame it to him in that way, that you saw it as a contradiction?
We never quite go to the point. You see the way it happened. There were never formal interviews, as we understand interviews here. I had a number of opportunities to be with him alone or just with one person. There were conversations rather than interviews. And therefore, I felt that my needs or my interests in researching this particular project would not be served by trying to polemicize or argue a point with him, you know, for one thing, not being a theologian. I felt that I would probably learn more if I spent most of the time listening and just asking questions that would, you know, hopefully help me to understand the positions, but I would not say, hey, Holy Father, you know, don't you understand that you're, you know, doing the church in by feeling this way, because I don't think it would have led to any particularly helpful answer and would have probably damaged the relationship. And since they were so generous with their time in these very informal situations, I felt I was learning much more doing that, which does not keep easy. It does not come easily to me, just keeping my mouth shut, but I did most of the time in that context.
So what was the atmosphere like when you were in a room with the Pope? What could you talk with him about?
Oh, the great moment that sticks in my mind is the time when, unexpectedly, early in the process, I was invited to have lunch in his private dining room in the papal apartments in the Vatican with only two other people, his Polish secretary, who has been with him forever and who is probably as influential a person as anyone in the Vatican. And very, very quickly, and we spoke Polish, which I do, and he is very, very partial to the Polish language. He relaxes. It's a form of, if you will, almost of rest for him. His body language changes when he shifts from Italian or Latin or what have you into Polish, and he becomes a very relaxed, very informal human being. And we just sat there chatting. You know, we arranged from Gorbachev to the diplomacy over communism and General Jaruzelski in Poland and the Middle East and his childhood and the time he was hit by the truck, by the German truck, and well, his father and his parents and Polish theater and Polish poetry. It was, you know, the kind of conversation you would have with a friend almost anywhere. And
Let me stop you here a second. Did you talk with the Pope at all about his stand on moral issues pertaining to sexuality and birth control? And let me expand on what I mean here. Did you talk to him about birth control, homosexuality, abortion, things that are not only sensitive issues for a lot of people in general, but I imagine these might be particularly complex issues to talk to the Pope about?
Yes, in the sense that, in a way, I had to make up my mind how best to use my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized very quickly, because I had read massively what he had said and written in public, I knew what his positions were, and I knew that to try to go into this beyond that which he has said endlessly would simply bring the same answer and indeed clarify very little, because sexuality, about which he has written books, held lectures. Love and Responsibility, Love and Marriage. You know, all these are books in which he endlessly, for hundreds of pages, discusses it. And since his views are so publicly stated and restated endlessly, I just felt that I wanted to go in, you know, in other directions. And again, as I said earlier, these were not interviews the way we do it here most of the time, where you sort of go down a list of questions, as you might do with the President of the United States or whomever. There it was, in every case, in the context and in the environment of a general conversation, you know, stopping at this point or that point. And I felt if I would say, "Holy Father, so why are you against contraception or homosexuality?" I would probably be given the same basically boilerplate answer that he's given endlessly. And I don't think I would have learned a great deal, and I would have wasted X minutes on something which I knew would be simply repeating the official texts.
I think a lot of women feel that the Pope doesn't understand what it's like to be a woman in the modern world today. Has the Pope been close to many women over the years?
Yes, in terms of personal friendships in high school, in university, in the theater, and the normal course of events. But once he became Pope, I think that disappeared very quickly. Back in Krakow as a cardinal, he had endless number of friends, intellectuals, artists were women and as well as men. That clearly ceased after he became Pope.
Tell me if you think I read your book accurately. I think I walk away with the impression from your biography that you find it something of a contradiction that the Pope has opened up the church, for instance, in terms of history. The Pope has challenged the church to rethink its stand on the Inquisition, on science, to exonerate Galileo, for instance. But at the same time, he's an absolutist on moral issues, on artificial contraception, on sexuality, homosexuality. Am I interpreting your book correctly, that you see this as a fundamental contradiction within the Pope?
It is a contradiction as we see it, you and I, and presumably millions of other people.
But not in his mind.
But clearly not in his mind, and he's a, you know, extremely rational person in every way. And to him, all these are perfectly compatible positions. He does not see contradiction because, again, let's go to the latest encyclical as an example. He feels that his views on abortion, contraception, capital punishment, they all go back to the to thou shalt not kill. So, you know, to us, of course, it's an intellectual contradiction, and we would say, how can a intelligent, progressive pope such as John Paul II hold that which we, when we look up on each of them one by one, see as, quote, conservative, reactionary, retrograde positions. And again, he is not, he obviously knows what he's saying. And to him, it is not a contradiction. It's his own vision of a moral stand that he and the church should take. And it's one of those take it or leave it alone, he says to fellow Catholics.
Ted Schultz is the author of a new biography of Pope John Paul II. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Villard Books, publisher of Wonder Boys, a new novel by Michael Chabon, author of Mysteries of Pittsburgh. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Paul Sims, the creator, writer, and producer of the new sitcom News Radio. It isn't surprising that his sitcom revolves around broadcasting. Sims used to write for Late Night with David Letterman and The Larry Sanders Show. And now that baseball players are getting ready to play ball again, Gerald Early has some thoughts about Jackie Robinson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has released a Labor Department survey of 250,000 working women. Some of the survey respondents say their biggest problem is balancing work and family. Many complain of making less money than men and that there's too much stress in their lives. The president says these are serious concerns.
If you think about the great challenges facing America today, resolving the dilemmas of working women are critical to our meeting them. Women want to be treated as assets to be developed in the workplace, not costs to be cut. They deserve to work in an environment that treats them with dignity, respects the value of their families, and invests in their skills and their future. This is not just the fair and decent thing to do. It is the smart thing to do.
President Clinton says one way he'll respond is to promote an increase in the minimum wage to $5.15 an hour. Majority Republicans have largely ignored the minimum wage proposal in Congress. They argue that raising the wage causes businesses to hire fewer people or lay off people to hold down costs. The White House wants a full investigation into alleged CIA links to murders in Guatemala. A memo to the chief investigator says President Clinton wants to know if there's any direct or indirect U.S. involvement in the case. The president ordered the investigation last month after a Guatemalan colonel on the CIA's payroll was implicated in the 1990s killings of an American innkeeper and a Guatemalan rebel married to an American woman. The probe will now go deeper. It will review the killings of three Americans, including the torture death of a Catholic nun in the 1980s. A touch of winter has returned to the Midwest today. Plunging temperatures accompanied snow, ice, and thunderstorms throughout the region. From Chicago, NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
Weather forecasters are calling this a major spring storm, and its effects are being felt in different ways, from the plains to the Great Lakes. Snow fell overnight in the upper Midwest, including the Dakotas and Michigan. At the same time, thunderstorms stirred up winds of almost 50 miles an hour, spreading sleet and hail from Kansas to Illinois. The unseasonable weather caused scattered power outages and air and ground traffic problems throughout the central states. Highway agencies in Iowa and South Dakota reported ice-coated roads this morning, and in Chicago, ice on the overhead wires also forced the disruption of one public transit line during the morning rush hour. Severe conditions have eased a bit during the day, but cold temperatures and additional storms are forecast in some parts of the Midwest through the middle of this week. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 5.5 points to end the day at 4,198. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. An eighth person has died from wounds suffered from yesterday's suicide bombings in Gaza. A 20-year-old American student who was declared brain dead earlier has died. Brandeis University student Elisa Flato's organs have been removed for donation. Two suicide attacks led to the deaths. 43 people were hurt. Palestinian police say they've arrested at least 150 Arab activists in connection with the bombing attacks. The Islamic Jihad has claimed responsibility for at least one attack. The French presidential election has entered its final stretch with a 2-week official television campaign. 9 candidates will be on the first ballot April 23rd, but only 3 have a chance of making it to the second ballot in early May. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The polls show 2 conservatives are out in front, Paris Mayor Jacques Chirac and Prime Minister Edouard Balladur. The other leading candidate is former Socialist Education Minister Lionel Jospin. Jospin has bobbed up and down in the polls, depending on the verbal sparring between the two conservatives, which has gotten increasingly vicious in recent weeks. Balladur has accused Chirac of being a demagogue, while the mayor has responded by suggesting that the prime minister is acting like a monarch. In the meantime, Lionel Jospin is quietly getting on with his campaign. He's trying to rally not only the socialist electorate, but also voters backing the communist and environmental candidates. He says he needs their support to make it to the second round. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Another member of a secretive Japanese sect has been arrested. The sect is suspected in the nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway. Police have now arrested four top members of the group. The latest person is suspected of obstructing police. He is a confidant of the sect leader, and he allegedly headed a firm that organized tours to Russia where participants worked on shooting skills. The sect claims 10,000 members in Japan, 30,000 in Russia. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Have you seen the new sitcom News Radio? It's not so much about broadcasting as it is about working in a fast-paced, high-pressured office. Of course, this office may have more than its share of backstabbing and secret romances. In a moment, we'll meet the show's writer, creator, and executive producer, Paul Sims. Phil Hartman, formerly of Saturday Night Live, plays the news anchor. Dave Foley, formerly of Kids in the Hall, plays the news director. In last week's episode, the third in the series, a new smoke-free ordinance forces anchor Phil Hartman to try to quit. In the spirit of solidarity, news director Dave Foley offers to give up coffee. Here they are after one night of abstinence.
Morning, Chief.
Morning, Bill.
So?
Nope. Haven't had a drop of coffee. You smoked?
Not at all. How you feeling?
Well, I have a pounding headache, and my arms feel like they're about 12 feet long. But other than that, I feel fine. You?
I've been better. Coughed up something that looked like escargot this morning. Well, I guess that's a good sign.
News Radio's creator, Paul Sims, used to write for the Harvard Lampoon, Spy Magazine, Late Night with David Letterman, and The Larry Sanders Show. He told me why he wanted to create a sitcom set in a high-pressured office.
There's a lot of shows right now that are all about people's leisure time. And when I watch Seinfeld, I love it. When I watch some of those other shows, I just think, you know, that does not resemble my life in any way. I work 12 or 14 hours a day. The important things that happen in my life, whether it's, you know, a birthday or breaking up with a girlfriend or getting a promotion, they all happen at work. I mean, that's where, the people, my friends and I spend most of our time. I don't know what it's like to have the kind of lifestyle where you hang around a coffee shop all day and then go for a walk and then rent some videos and then hang out and just rap about who's dating who.
In the series opener, a new news director is hired, mm-hmm. and he comes in to find out that his predecessor doesn't know that he's been fired. Mm-hmm. So the new news director's first job is to fire the guy he's supposed to be replacing. Have you ever come across something like that in real life?
Actually, situations similar to that two or three times, yeah.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, well, I work out in Hollywood, so nothing venal or greedy is remarkable. Now, the other thing I thought that was interesting about that episode was that it was the new news director was a younger guy, and there's something sad and very difficult about a younger person having to fire an older person. But I think it's something that a lot of especially ambitious younger people in the workplace end up having to do these days, and it's horrible.
In the second episode,
yes,
of Radio News, you know, there's
News Radio.
I'm sorry. There's sexual tension between the woman who thinks she should have been promoted to news director and the new news director. There have been whole series that have been, that have run for months or years on the kind of sexual tension between two people who work together and are trying to not actually get together. So here you are in the separate episode.
Well,
why did you decide to do that?
So much of what I wanted to do with this show was defined by what I didn't want it to be. Mm-hmm. I was saying about the pace, I didn't want it to have a leisurely pace because I'm tired of seeing that. The other thing was, I think, you know, whenever you do anyone doing a romance on a sitcom, the natural way to go is will they or won't they, and this tension and the battle and all that. I think Cheers did that and did it better than anyone else, and you can't do it anymore.
News Radio has a laugh track. Did you want that?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have a laugh. It has a live audience.
Oh, it's a live audience. Okay.
Yeah.
You never know.
I know. Well, it drives me crazy because it does, because we still haven't gotten that right, the way it's recorded. But no, I wanted, after working at Larry Sanders, I wanted to do a show in front of a studio audience, because I used to work at Late Night with David Letterman, and I loved the excitement of having a live audience there and hearing the actual response. So I wanted a live audience. The way we do the show is that we bring the audience in and they watch a tape of the pilot, and then we perform the entire show like a play. Unless there's a technical problem, we don't stop and go back and, you know, try to do something differently with the audience sitting there. We go straight through the show once in front of the audience. And then the audience leaves, and then we go back and pick up whatever, you know, mistakes we needed to fix. But
and then you use the laughs from the original audience?
Yeah, we use the laughs from the original audience. And actually, we use most of the actual performance in front of the original audience. The only time it's different is recently with more of the episodes, we've been, after we see it in front of the audience, then we sort of rewrite it on its feet to fix things that we felt were confusing or didn't quite work. But I am frustrated because, you know, those are real laughs on there. But when you see it on TV, it just, you assume it's, you know, to me it sounds fake even. So I don't know what the answer to that is. You know, and then every once in a while you get a bad audience, which so far for us hasn't meant a dead audience. It's not laughing. But we had one episode where it was very frustrating because I guess it was a lot of, it sounded like a lot of frat guys or something in the audience, and everything that even mildly resembled a sexual joke or something, they would hoot and scream and holler, and, you know, so then you have to find a way of erasing that.
Paul Sims is my guest. He's the creator of the new sitcom News Radio. You used to work on the Larry Sanders Show. What was it like to write episodes around real people who would be invited on to play themselves? Did you often strike out in convincing the real person to come on as themselves?
Yeah, you know, relentlessly. We would always, it's odd. Some of them were so, you know, so enthusiastic about it. It was great. Like Alec Baldwin actually called Gary himself, and Sharon Stone did the same thing, and Letterman did the same thing. I mean, they didn't call Gary, but some people were just very, you know, got the show and were excited about doing it. In other cases, we would go through six people before we found someone that would do it. And, you know, not all of it was people playing themselves. A lot of it was about availability. But once you got someone who would do the show, you know, a celebrity who would do the show, they were all, almost to a person, had no objections about doing anything. They were happy to play themselves. I think the way Gary works with them helped a lot, and that they would rehearse the scenes and ad-lib and you know, come up with something that felt natural for the person. And I think a lot of those actors, you know, enjoyed having that much input into what they were doing.
So before you worked with Gary Shandling, you worked on The Letterman Show.
Yeah.
Give me a sense of what it was like behind the scenes in the office. I mean, it's a daily show, a lot of pressure.
It was a very high-pressure office. But also there is a very comfortable routine to it. You know, at exactly, you know, 4:30 every day, the top 10 list had to be finished. At exactly 5, Dave would go downstairs. At exactly 5:30, the show would start. At 6:30, it would be over. I mean, there was never any, you know, delay of anything. And then from 6:45 till midnight, we would sit in a room and try to write stuff.
Did the Conan O'Brien show give a lot of writers ideas that they should have their own shows too?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I think, you know, it's weird. I think with TV writers, there are two kinds of TV writers, you know, I mean, to make a gross oversimplification. They're the kinds who are performers and enjoy talking and enjoy, you know, coming up with stuff verbally. And then there are the ones that are writers who enjoy sitting alone in a room and just writing everything down. And I mean, you can tell any show you go to, you can, you know, the balance is about 50-50. I don't know. I think there's probably, at least 3,000 or 4,000 TV writers in Hollywood who think they should have their own show.
Right. So which kind of writer are you? The kind of guy who writes alone or in a group?
Nah, writes alone.
Really?
I much prefer to write alone or with one or two other people. You know, the way a lot of TV shows are written is it's written in a big group and, you know, it's 10 or 12 people sitting around a table writing by committee. And I just think that's painful and it just homogenizes everything and is bad for what you ultimately get. So at my show, we've been working, you know, sometimes we work together with each other, but it's never more than three people together at once. And generally, that's just a matter of rewriting. I think I just don't think you can write scenes with real characters in a group like that because it becomes too much a matter of getting good lines and people wanting to get the funniest line in. And before you know it, you have a whole page with very funny lines, but none of it seems real.
My guest is Paul Sims, the writer, creator, and executive producer of the sitcom News Radio. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Paul Sims is my guest. He's the creator of the new sitcom News Radio. Now, I understand you grew up in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan?
Yeah, that's right. When I was three, I was born in California. When I was three, my family moved to Pakistan. Then when I was seven, we moved to Saudi Arabia, and I stayed there until high school. My parents were school teachers at American schools overseas.
What I find really remarkable about this is that you grew up so far away from American popular culture, and you've become such a part of it. And the shows that you've worked on are shows, well, particularly Letterman and Chandling, I mean, they're shows that kind of parody all the conventions of television. Were you able to see much American television in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan?
Really, hardly any at all. In Pakistan, I think we had no American television. I think there was I remember seeing Star Trek once, and then I remember And I remember seeing a dress by Benazir Bhutto's father, but it was in Urdu, so I didn't understand it. And in Arabia, it was the same. In Arabia, they had a little more television, but it was sort of from, you know, it was old lousy shows that they, you know, bought from America. And it wasn't on, you know, 24 hours a day. I think it was on like 4 or 5 hours at nighttime. So I don't really know how I absorbed all of this. I mean, I read a lot, and I remember wishing I could watch television, and any book I could find about television or anything, I would read.
So, how old were you when you moved to the States?
I guess I was about 14 or 15. My parents stayed in Arabia, and I went to a boarding school in California.
So, what was it like to watch American TV?
It was very exciting. I remember when we used to come on vacations to the States, my brother and I would be glued to the TV set for the entire, you know, 3 weeks we were here. When I went to boarding school, I was so excited about actually being able to see TV. But then there's, you know, rules at the boarding school that you couldn't have a TV in your room. So there was a TV available. I think it was from 9 o'clock to 10:30 at night. So whatever happened to be on then, you could watch. But a friend of mine got one of those little miniature TVs, though, but I only used it to watch Late Night with David Letterman, which was just starting around then. So I used to watch that under the covers in my little dorm room.
Well, getting back to News Radio, Sex in the Office is one of the big things.
Yes.
You know, literally sex in the office and relations between people who share an office. But this kind of thing must have been quite a difference to you, having come from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, where I imagine that isn't a kind of typical office situation.
I think offices are the same wherever you go. You know, whenever you have a group of people working in the same place, particularly if there's a group of younger people and single people, I think the same situations tend to come up over and over again. one of the most important things I learned growing up overseas is that people, no matter, you know, what country they're from or what customs or what religion they are more similar to each other than they are different from each other. I think a lot is made of the cultural differences between Americans and everyone else. But, you know, actually, it sounds trite and cliche, but people are the same wherever you go.
You're 29 now and have so far been real successful.
Yeah.
Do you worry about the future? You know, like, oh, things sometimes don't last that long in Hollywood?
Well, things don't last that long in Hollywood, so that's a given. So I'm trying to enjoy this while it lasts. Part of it is I don't worry about that too much because right now the work is so enjoyable. You know, it's so much fun. It's so much fun having this having my chance to actually, you know, realize this my vision of the show the way I want to. Yeah, things don't last, and, you know, I'm 29 now. You know, 5 years from now, I'll be doing something else, and then when I'm around 38 or 39, I won't even be able to get hired on a TV show because things will have changed, and I'll be a little too old to be thinking the right way. And, you know, by 42, I'll, you know, have a gun in my mouth.
Well, a happy
but then
scenario.
You know what? But then you know, then I'm sorry. Then you know, then I'll end up in a hospital. Then I'll get all straightened out. Then when I'm 45, you know, I'll.
Some point your shows will be on in reruns, and there will be a revival of your career.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
And you will
about
be
that.
Revered by new yeah. people coming into the profession.
Me and George Goober Lindsay of Mayberry RFD will both be together at the autograph conventions. I forgot about that. I forgot that there's a shorter time span now between the original thing that's popular and its revival as an item of nostalgia, considering now that we're up to the, 70s now. So now's the 90s. So by the year 2010 or 2007, I should be able to get a lot of money for any kind of old junk, old props from news radio or something. I think there'll be a big collector's market for that.
Paul Sims is the writer, creator, and executive producer of the sitcom News Radio. It's broadcast Tuesday nights on NBC. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, there's a new GOP presidential contender.
Hi, Terry. Senator Bob Dole announcing in Kansas, formally, the third time he'll try for the presidency. In other stories, Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto meets tomorrow with President Clinton. She'll be asking for normalized relations between the two countries. Eric Weiner has that story. NPR's Maria Inahosa reports tonight on a group of skinheads in eastern Pennsylvania. She'll be talking there with young people who are involved in the movement. There's a new study out from the Carnegie Foundation saying that many of the efforts to reform elementary schools in this country are misguided. Also, with Passover in mind, cooking kugel.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For the first time, there's a full-length biography of the man who broke baseball's color barrier. That's just one of the reasons commentator Gerald Early has been thinking about Jackie Robinson.
As we near 1997 and the 50th anniversary of the integration of Major League Baseball, there has been a mounting interest in the life and career of Jackie Robinson. First, Ken Burns' mammoth documentary on baseball was framed around Jackie Robinson. As Burns himself made clear to me, he saw the story of baseball as the story of race in America, and he saw Jackie Robinson as the hero of the tale. Most critics consider the episode that dealt with the Brooklyn Dodgers star to be the most compelling and passionately rendered of the series. Second, two major Robinson books have appeared. The Echo Press has republished I Never Had It Made, the last and best of Robinson's autobiographies, completed shortly before his death in 1972. And Simon & Schuster has published the first full-length biography of Robinson, Great Time Coming, The Life of Jackie Robinson from Baseball to Birmingham by David Faulkner. Jules Tigel's Baseball's Great Experiment, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy, probably the best book on Robinson before Faulkner's, covered only Robinson's professional playing career. Faulkner's fine biography looks not only at the baseball career, but at the troubled and frustrating years of Robinson after baseball. His struggle in trying to find a place for himself as a prominent and politically committed black man in the turbulent America of the 1950s and 1960s. Robinson's impact on our culture extends far beyond his professional baseball career. In thinking about the last few years of Robinson's life, one is struck by how much he resembles a hero from Greek tragedy. Blinded and made nearly immobile by diabetes, foundering politically between Republican conservatism and civil rights activism, distressingly estranged from his eldest son, Jackie Jr., Robinson seems so much like the lion in Winter, the flawed, dying, mythic giant of American culture. Pride and rage had kept him alive and made him great, and now that pride and rage, scorned by both the militants and the establishment, would kill him. Only a few great African-American sports heroes have had the same impact on American social and cultural history as Robinson. Probably only Joe Louis and Muhammad Ali, both of whom, like Robinson, transcended their sport. When Jackie Robinson broke in, my grandfather told all his children, "A black man's coming into baseball." It was a time of rejoicing in that house and many others like it. Whenever my grandfather talked to me about baseball, which he did on a number of occasions as he was a rabid fan, he almost always, in some way or another, mentioned Jackie Robinson. I think it was because Robinson represented a vigorous and gallant expression of black manhood. "He was a strong man," my grandfather said. Robinson was driven by a great competitive urge which made him a legendary high school and college athlete in California. But he was also driven by a sensitivity and pride that manifested itself almost purely as contained rage. This served him well in his days as a baseball player. Even in the early days of the great experiment, when Dodger general manager Branch Rickey had Robinson turn the other cheek to taunts and abuse from opposing players and fans, the anger burning inside him was apparent to all and gave him a transcendent dignity. But the rage served him less well in his life outside sports. He never had the finesse to succeed in the raging political waters of the 1950s and 1960s when he was active in the civil rights struggle. But Robinson was that rare person in our age who took on the symbolic burden of his people and never let it fall. Like a bowed, wretchedly aged, but unbroken monarch, Robinson was the true American hero of the American century.
Gerald Early teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. His latest collection of essays, The Culture of Bruising, recently won a National Book Critics Circle Award. I'm Terry Gross.
Yes, Jackie hit that ball.
And when he swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, suburban gangs. We talk with journalist Dan Corum about the growing number of gangs in affluent communities. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.